listen, the birds sing. Listen, the bells ring. All the living are dead, and the dead are all living. The war is over, and we are beginning.
Chapter 11. Steve likes the subway. He gets on the 2 train every morning with the same group of commuters, and it's almost like he's got a steady 9-to-5 job. And he's never once, not even when he was small, had a steady 9-to-5 job. But he almost does now, and he finally understands the appeal of knowing exactly where you're going to be on any given day. There's relief in the stability of it all. He has train friends now. George, the middle-aged lawyer who shows Steve pictures of his kids on his phone. Laurie, a girl around Steve's age who works in marketing, her suit professional and her hair bright purple and her nose pierced. Nico and Troy, a couple who met on this train. They live a block apart in Brooklyn and work a block apart in Manhattan. Steve got caught staring at their joined hands one too many mornings, and when Nico glared at him and pulled Troy a little closer, chin held high and stubborn, Steve grinned big and introduced himself simply as Steve. He can't tell if any of his commuter friends know who he is. Rachel, Beck and Natasha all laugh and say, yes, they absolutely know who he is. They're just being New York aloof about celebrities. But for 24 minutes in the mornings, he's just like everyone else. He goes to work on the train, making easy conversation with those equally interested in easy conversation. Just nodding a hello on the mornings when George naps, Laurie's got her headphones in, or Nico and Troy are lost in their own little world together. Today, Laurie gets off with him at 42nd Street. As they emerge together from the platform, Laurie's talking his ear off about seeing some band at some underground club in Brooklyn. You should totally come, she says when they get out on the sidewalk. My friend is friends with the sound guy, and I can totally get you on the list. What do you say? But Steve stopped listening, because Natasha's on the corner, looking serious. She's decked out in leather, arms crossed over her chest, and she gives him a rueful little smile. It must be a big mission, if she's meeting him out on the street instead of waiting to ambush him over coffee. Holy moly! Laurie grips his arm. That's the Black Widow! Oh my god, she's coming over here! Do I look okay? Is my makeup doing something funky? Says Steve. Laurie is apparently capable of keeping her cool around Captain America, but has no such ambitions about her favourite Avenger. It's a pity. Natasha's gone out of her way to keep her face out of the public view, but those YouTube videos of her punching aliens will forever be on the internet. Hi, says Natasha. She then offers to take a selfie with Laurie, makes a little small talk, and send her on her way, all in less than 30 seconds. You're efficient, Steve says, waving at Laurie as she crosses the street. So that's your type, huh? Natasha smirks. Alternative and so short you could carry her around with one arm? Steve blinks at her. What? Good to know. I'll keep that in mind when I find you a date. What? Natasha gets serious again. We've got a mission. It's a bona fide supervillain. Some megalomaniac in possession of some otherworldly power, with some plot to take over the world. S.H.I.E.L.D. finally finds him hiding out in an abandoned train car in Moldova. Even from 100 yards out, as the team gets into position, that goddamn train car makes something crack in his chest. There ain't even any fucking tracks, or a nice icy ravine to hang over. It's just an old boxcar. But the sight of it alone has Steve's palms sweating. Saliva floods his mouth. He swallows it down along with the panic and whispers over the comms. On my mark. The mission goes fine. They surround the guy, apprehending him with ease. One glance around the tiny boxcar makes it clear that this is not the location where he's keeping the alien magical science fiction thing he was planning to use to take over the world. So they'll have to bring him in for a nice, long interrogation to find out where he stashed it. The whole thing goes by the book, until the very last minute, when they're marching Mr. World Domination towards the Quinjet. Steve and Clint bring up the rear, doing a final sweep, while Natasha gets the Quinjet up and running. Somehow, while they're all occupied, the would-be comic book fiend somehow gets a hold of a knife, slashing at the pair of young agents in charge of getting up the gangway. Agent Rumlow ends up putting a bullet through his head right as Steve runs up to disarm him, making the whole venture irrelevant. It's been a long time since Steve felt the hot spray of blood on his skin. He blinks and wipes his eyes. It feels like someone else's too big hand, ineffectually cleaning someone else's too big face, like Steve suddenly watching the mission completely fall apart from very far away. He stays like that, disconnected from his own body, as they hustle back onto the Quinjet. Natasha is furious, but he's watching her seethe through a thick piece of glass, her words muted. Her rage is cool and quiet, but utterly terrifying. He always found this breed of anger understated, simmering, calculating, dangerous, to be far more alarming than raised voices. Bucky's mother was like this, with her anger. Even that realization does not make him feel sad or fond or nostalgic or anything at all. Natasha appears to blame Rumlow for losing the captive, and all the intelligence in his head with him, instead of the freshman agent responsible for disarming him once they had him secured. Rumlow gets defensive, claims he was protecting the team. He tries to get Clint on his side, and then turns to Steve when that proves a lost cause. Save it for the debrief. Steve manages to sound just like Captain America, even from a million miles away. The flight back is long, hours and hours, but it seems to pass in a blink. As they disembark at the SHIELD airstrip outside the city, Steve tries to recall even a moment of the flight and can't manage it. He's out of his uniform, in SHIELD grey sweats and a zip-up, but he doesn't remember changing. Even his shield's been wiped down and packed up. He'd never let anyone do this for him, and usually he appreciates the ritual of running a polishing cloth over the surface, but he can't remember that either. This should scare him. Probably would, if you weren't looking through the world through thick glass. Hey, Natasha says. Her hand looks so small on his bulging forearm, and he blinks at it, imagining what it would look like if he were still 110 pounds. Maybe he should draw it. He hasn't drawn a single thing in the 21st century so far. You okay? Sure, says Steve. He doesn't smile at her. This mission was a failure. Even Captain America should be grim at such times. Why don't you go to Brooklyn? I will, after the debrief. They'll meet with Fury at the offices at Times Square. Normally, DC is the head of operations, but they're working out of the city for him, because they know he wants to go home to Brooklyn at night. It's late, Natasha insists. Her fingers tighten on his arm, tight enough that he actually feels it. Steve's got to lock his knees to keep from crumbling, lock his jaw to keep his expression blank. He's suddenly so exhausted. Tensions are still running high. I want to sleep off my Rumlow rage before I say something I'll regret in the morning. Steve very much doubts that Natasha wants to sleep on it for her own benefit, but he appreciates her framing it that way, nonetheless. All right, he agrees, backing away, moving towards his bike in the hangar. I'll see you at 0700. Make it 0800, Natasha says, also backing away, moving in the other direction towards Clint. That jet lag will mess you up. Yeah, he murmurs to himself. It's the jet lag. It's not that late, but Steve doesn't realize it until he's back in the neighborhood, surprised to find the street still full of traffic. Inside, Steve glances through the glass doors in the elevator lobby, watching Tammy laugh with Eduardo. Tammy's got stickers on all 10 fingers, reached out towards Eduardo and tracing him around the couch. They're both laughing and happy and alive. Steve's got someone else's blood dried into his eyebrow. Now he's actually watching people through real glass instead of the metaphorical sort, but their laughter helps. He's more present now. This big body feels like his own again. A moment later, Tammy trips over nothing at all, and she takes down Eduardo when she falls. They land together in an ungainly heap, still laughing, and they both see Steve at the same time. They wave at him enthusiastically, even as they elbow each other, trying to stand back up. Steve doesn't even have to use his Captain America smile. His grin is genuine, and he waves back, but he gets on the elevator instead of stopping to chat with the kids. Letting himself into the apartment, Steve stays as quiet as possible in case the girls are sleeping. They are just as likely to go to bed at 6 p.m. as they are to stay up till 3 a.m. Except the girls aren't anywhere, not asleep in their room or in front of the TV. They're not out on the balcony. Rachel's not knitting in her sewing room. Beck's not writing in her office. There's just a note, scribbled in Rachel's messy cursive. At Mount Sinai, Beck couldn't breathe. Check your phone. It's a pretty standard flare-up, Mia tells them. She found Steve where he was doing a terrible job explaining to the front desk who he's here to see and why. Without her, Steve would still be standing there, in a haze. He doesn't remember coming to the hospital, just blinking and suddenly finding himself in a waiting room. He loathes hospitals. The sterile smell reminds him of his mother, who's not ever coming back. It reminds him of almost dying over and over again, too weak to even sit up. But now it's Beck in a bed. She's there because she can't breathe, and Steve was a world away with blood splattered across his face when it happened. Next to him, Rachel's huddled close in her own stiff waiting room chair. She looks every one of her 90 years. She's tired, but resigned, and Steve can't even hold her hand out of fear of crushing her fingers in his super-soldered grip. Instead, he clenches his hands together in his lap, Rachel's hand wrapped tight around his elbow. Rachel's thoughts seem to be getting away from her more than they usually do, every moment a struggle for her to stay focused on Mia. Steve's having that problem too. Mia's gonna have to repeat herself. Mia might already be repeating herself. She's got an infection in her lungs, acute bronchitis. Mia is direct and professional. Steve finds himself nodding along. They're going to keep her for a bit, monitor her breathing and make sure it's clearing up all right. But as of now, it looks like she's going to come out of it fine, all right? She's going to be weak from this whole thing, and she needs rest. I know she's stubborn about going home before the doctors recommend she should, so we'll call in some more help when she does. I'll talk to visiting angels. Maybe get Emma to come back. You liked Emma. She looks like Vivian Lee, Rachel murmurs. Mia smiles and leans forward in her seat, squeezing Rachel's hand. Steve can't even do that. Steve is useless. She's going to recover, Rachel. It's going to clear up, and she's going to come home. This time, Rachel whispers. It should clear up this time. Yes, this time. I know we've talked about the possibility that she won't bounce back from one of these infections, but that does not appear to be what's happening right now. She's going to get better. This time, Rachel says again. Natasha gets him out of the briefing, somehow, so Steve gets to spend most of the next week at the hospital. He drives Rachel home at night so she can get some sleep, and he drives her back in the morning, but he doesn't sleep much himself. He just stares at the ceiling, feeling small and sickly and incapable to do anything for the people he cares about. When Beck finally comes home, the doctor wants her to stay in bed and eat more, to gain back some of the weight she lost when she was sick. Beck's too weak to argue. She's on oxygen all the time now, has an improved regime of steroids and nebulizers and modern things that might have helped with Steve's breathing if they'd been around 100 years ago. Bring me my computer, Steve-o. Beck's propped up on some pillows in bed, her voice nothing but a murmur. Rachel wouldn't be able to hear her at all if she was in here instead of running herself ragged, stress-knitting in the living room. Why don't you get some rest, Rebecca? No, she hisses, angry and strong and fierce. She sounds like her mother. She looks like her mother. And Steve's practically wired to go along with Barnes women when they're glaring at him like that. I'll have plenty of time to rest when I'm dead, which is going to be sooner rather than later. Rebecca. And I'm finishing that goddamn book if it's the last goddamn thing I goddamn do. Steve squeezes his eyes shut so hard that he sees spots behind his eyelids. He forgets to breathe for a minute, takes a lot of breaths very fast to catch up, and then stands from the easy chair in the corner to pace around the length of her bed. She tracks his movements with her eyes, but doesn't say anything. I don't know if I can publish it back. I just don't know yet. I want to, but when I think about actually doing it, I feel sick. Sick to my stomach. Like the ulcers are back. Beck's the sick one. All she wants in the world is to get this book out in the world, and he can't even give her that. He's useless. Absolutely useless. Steve. Beck rolls her eyes in truly epic fashion for someone who just spent a week in the hospital. I said I wanted to get the book finished, not that I wanted to get it published. That's still your decision. I ain't gonna use my impending demise to guilt you into coming out to the entire world. Jesus Christ. He drops down onto the end of the bed. Oh. It's important, okay? She wheezes and wheezes, and then takes a full minute to breathe before continuing. I want it written down because that's what I do. I write it all down, and this is important because it was our lives, our family. It happened and it was real, and for once I just want the truth written down. Yeah, that... Steve clears his throat. That sounds real good, Beck. When we're done, you can burn the only copy. You can smash my computer to bits. You can leave the manuscript in a drawer, and maybe in 5,000 years some future archaeologist will uncover it and rewrite our history long after we're all dust. What? Steve asks, smiling. You really think they're going to be interested in us in 5,000 years? They're going to still be marveling over you in 10. Go get the laptop. Steve goes to get the laptop. Steve goes to work on the 2 train. Steve does not talk to his train friends. Steve gets coffee with Clint and trains with Natasha. Rumlow is conspicuously absent. Steve pummels 4 punching bags into smithereens and then hits the showers. It's a familiar routine, but today he's just going through the motions, because he's useless to Rachel and Beck. They told him he needed to get out of the house, get some fresh air. And Steve didn't know what else to do but to follow his routine. There's no joy in it. Maybe he'll take the train home instead of jogging like he normally does. He's so wrapped up in his head, debating the pros and cons of taking the train home, that he doesn't see Agent Hill waiting for him in the hall outside the locker room until he's nearly walking into her. Got a minute? She asks. Sure, replies Steve, like he's really got a choice. Her office has a pretty decent view of Times Square, and Steve figures most people would be impressed. Steve tilts his chair away and tries not to look out the window at all those flashing lights. Agent Hill starts off with bland, easy questions that Steve answers with canned Captain America in the USO show answers. He keeps his face smooth and open, his voice low and calm, a small smile at the ready, but not too ready. The same tactics he used to get through this endless psychological exams in the first few weeks after the Chitauri. How are you settling in? How's Brooklyn and Mrs. and Mrs. Barnes? You sure you wouldn't be more comfortable in your own place? We can set you up somewhere nice, wherever you want. How about that internet, huh? But then the inevitable question. The one he's both been hoping for and dreading. All this, the catch-up history lessons, the crash courses on technology and social media, extensive training, combat, and modern weaponry, has all been for one goal. S.H.I.E.L.D. wants their weapon back, and not just for the occasional mission here and there. They want him back permanently. They want him taking orders with a diminished ability to say no. We're putting together a highly specialized strike team, and we want you to lead it. I'll think about it. This, says Steve, tugging on Rachel's wrist. Her attention is elsewhere, her eyes focused on Raoul at the other end of the bar, where he's standing on a table, singing his heart out, in a language Steve can't understand. Or maybe it's plain old English, and Steve's just too drunk to understand it. That's why his skin is so flushed. It's just alcohol. There's no soreness in his throat, and that headache he was sporting before drink number four was nothing at all. Steve was healthy for 1940, and now he's just drunk. "This what, Bubba?" Rachel asks, smiling as Raoul nearly tumbles over. At least 8 pairs of hands reach up to steady him. It seems everyone Steve's ever seen wander into Sully's since the spring of 38 is here tonight to ring in the new year. Sully's got someone watching the door, only letting in people on a list, people confirmed as safe and not likely to turn out to be narcs and blackmailers. Rachel's even got the night off and managed to coax the group of academic lesbians they know through Zelda somehow into attending their festivities. So it's not just punks and fairies and drag queens, but women too. There's not much moving around room, but Bucky's managing to swing Zelda around on the packed dance floor anyway. This place. Steve manages as someone sticks a fresh drink in his hand. It must be near midnight.
The bar, you mean? Rachel says.
He's got her attention fully now, her arm thrown over his shoulder as she pulls him close to speak right in his good ear.
Sure, it's great, Steve says.
His speech is slurred, but he's not embarrassed, because it makes Rachel giggle, and if there is anyone in the whole world that deserves a good laugh, it's her.
But what I'm trying to say is that this year's been the best year.
Rachel nods, her smile going soft.
It's one for the history books, that's for sure.
Steve frowns as he recalls that 1940 hasn't just been about building a little family and finding a home in a bar and Bucky in his bed every night. It's also been Blitzkrieg, German Jews with yellow stars on their chests, and signing up with Bucky for selective service, knowing that Bucky's just what the military wants, while Steve's nothing. How can the best year of his life be one of the worst for the world? But Rachel rubs his shoulder, still smiling. She seems to understand. In the last few minutes before 1941, Steve's going to let himself be blissfully, uncomplicatedly happy.
I think this was the best year of my life, Rach, he says. I mean, there were good times with my ma, of course, but it's different when you're a kid. This is the best year of my grown-up life. Because of you. Because of Bucky.
Because you've drawn about 1,000 dirty pictures, and one of Zelda's bosses at the hospital paid me to make her a dress.
Because I didn't get sick, and neither did you.
Because we got a good thing going on here, like a real family or something.
Because we're in love.
Yes, Rachel says.
And you're going to marry me and we're going to live queerly ever after.
Queerly ever after? Steve laughs. You should cross-stitch that on a pillow.
You should cross-stitch it on a pillow, Rachel corrects. I've got dresses to make.
And then the whole bar around them is counting down and singing so loud that his good ear is going to be ringing tomorrow. Bucky appears out of nowhere, all sweaty from the crowds and the dancing. Steve opens his mouth to say something, but Bucky just grabs his face between both hands, kissing him silly. Dizzy with joy, he laughs into Bucky's mouth and clings to his shirt.
Welcome to the new year, sweetheart, Bucky says while Steve tries to catch his breath.
His knees are weak, his vision swimming, and everyone is pressed in so close, celebrating. Peter kisses both Bucky's cheeks while he laughs. Sully lifts Rachel off her feet in a hug. People are talking to him, too, but it's all a blur, and he just leans back against Bucky. Eventually, Rachel's hugging him, talking right in his good ear. She giggles and slurs her words, saying,
"This year's going to be even better, just you wait. We're going to make 41 the best year of our lives."
And Steve sees absolutely no reason not to believe her.
"1941. The worst year of Steve's life starts with a burning fever and bombs in London. He wakes up on January 1st with a massive headache, barely making it to the trash bin before he's emptying his stomach. Bucky's not much better off, after the night they had. The only difference being, Bucky wakes up on January 2nd perfectly fine, while Steve's burning up with a 100-degree fever. Bucky pulls the blankets up to his chin. He says, "Looks like a flu." And Steve loses track of time. Bedridden and delirious, Steve spends days muttering about US neutrality and Neville Chamberlain. "It's Churchill now, buddy." Bucky wipes sweat from Steve's forehead with a damp rag. "Why does Rachel look so scared?" Steve struggles to lift his head. Through the haze in his mind, he's almost certain he can see Rachel lingering in the doorway to their bedroom, chewing on her fingernails. "Is it the Nazis? Are they here? Buck, Bucky, honey, we gotta fight the Nazis. Someone's gotta do it. Gotta keep them away from Rachel. You know Hitler hates everyone I love? Queers and Jews, the lot of you. And me, sickly little invalid. Inferior. Good thing I'm not in the business of pitching woo to any girls, huh, Buck? Better I just let this fever have me than pass on those weak, defective genetics to a kid." "Stop talking like that, Steve." Bucky sounds like he's in pain, like it's his skin on fire instead of Steve's. Like his brain is banging around against his skull, reality a wispy, intangible thing that keeps slipping through his fingers. Bucky's voice strains like he's hurting, but his hands are gentle as they push at Steve's shoulders until he's lying flat in their bed again. "They're bombing London," Steve says. "The radio says so. Why does Rachel look so scared?" "She looks like that because you're spending more time fretting over fascism than getting yourself better." "Oh," says Steve. "I'll get better. Don't you worry about that. I always get better. You think I'm going to give Hitler the satisfaction of letting a little sickness take me out? No, sir." "I know you won't," says Bucky. He pushes his hand through Steve's hair, and normally that feels real nice, but Steve's brain is rattling around inside his skull, so he's got to pull away from Bucky's hand, whimpering. "You're a fighter, Stevie," Bucky murmurs, his hand flat on the mattress now. "A Nazi fighter," Steve agrees, his eyes slipping closed. "Someone's gotta do it." "How about you fight this fever first, huh?" "If I must." Bucky chuckles a little, but it still sounds like his skin is on fire. "I gotta go to work now, pal," he whispers. "And after that, I'm doing a shift at the garage." "With your tata?" "That's good." Steve would smile a little, if his skin were just a few degrees cooler. He'd be able to think right, if his skin were just a few degrees cooler. "With tata." Bucky misses his father in the garage. That was their thing, growing up. Steve would talk about politics with George over chess games, and Bucky would follow him around in the garage, maintaining the fleet of trucks that made the barn something almost like rich. That's good. Bucky's forgiven his father, even if Steve can't, and he should just quit his refinery job and go to the garage all the time because he loves it. "You should just quit your refinery job and go to the garage all the time." "Stop talking, Steve." "You love it." "I love you, maybe, if you can shut up for 5 minutes. Can you try to get some rest? If you sleep for a while, Rachel might look less scared when you wake up." "You're managing me, Bucky. You know how I feel about being managed." "Just sleep," Bucky says, but Steve's already halfway there. When he wakes up, his mother is with him. She's got a chair pulled up to his bedside. Her shoes are off, but she's still in her nurse uniform. Steve's shivering now, so sick after a year of staying relatively healthy, and he's glad she's here. It's been a long time since he's seen her, although he can't recall why that would be. He wants to tell her about loving Bucky. Steve closes his eyes, just needing to rest them for a few seconds, and when he opens them again, his ma turns into Zelda, and Steve remembers that she's been dead since 1935. "You look like my ma," Steve says, his voice croaky and thin. "That's very flattering." Zelda looks up from the book in her lap. "From what I understand, she was quite the lady." "Yeah." "I wish I had even a drop of her artistic talent," Zelda says. "The landscapes are hers, right?"
She started teaching me to draw before even teaching me to walk. Zelda's got a very soft, tinkling laugh. She stands up and comes closer, gesturing for Steve to open up for a thermometer. He complies willingly, slipping it under his tongue as Zelda looks at her watch. "She was a hell of a nurse, too," he mumbles. "Kept me alive for a long time." "You can tell me about it in another 2 minutes," Zelda scolds. "Keep your mouth closed." 2 minutes later, Zelda makes a satisfied little sound when she retrieves her thermometer. Steve doesn't ask for the exact temperature, but if Zelda is pleased, then he is too. His mind is clearer than it's been since he first started to get feverish, and instead of crawling or burning, his skin just feels disgustingly clammy. He wants a bath, but the ache in his limbs is so deep, Steve doesn't think he'll make it to the tub on his own. "Rachel left soup," Zelda says. "We haven't been able to get you to eat much more than a few spoonfuls of broth in days." "Days?" Steve groans. He hates losing time like this. Anything could be happening with the war. For all he knows, it's over, and Hitler's been made the ruler of all of Europe, and parts of the Middle East and Africa, too. 6 days, since you're even a little coherent," Zelda says. He's glad it's Zelda here. She's a good nurse. Honest, but not too blunt. Not angry at the universe for making Steve sick like Bucky is, or bursting out into tears every 3 seconds like Rachel. "We had a doctor in here on day 3, when it was really bad and we didn't want to risk moving you. Your fever broke last night. I'm getting you soup." So Steve lets Zelda do her nursing. She helps prop him up on all the pillows they own and gets a tray on his lap for the soup. He eats the whole bowl like she tells him to, even though he's left sloshing and full when he's done. He takes every bit of medicine she offers him, including the arsenal of medication he always takes for his myriad of chronic conditions, even though his faulty heart or his struggling lungs do not appear to currently be his main health concerns. "Is there a paper lying around?" he asks her, when he stumbles back into bed after an exhausting trip to the toilet. "No," says Zelda. When he was gone, she changed the sweaty sheets on the bed. He hates to ruin the fresh sheets with his clammy skin, but they feel so good beneath him he has to bite back a groan. "Want to put on the radio, then?" He curls up on his side and closes his eyes. "No," says Zelda. "What do you mean, no? Did that old thing finally kick the bucket?" "No, I mean there's currently a ban on all news in this apartment," she explains, busying herself with tidying up the room. Later, when Steve has more energy, he'll be embarrassed that she's seen him like this, even if it is her job. Maybe he'll finally get around to turning that sketch of her and Rachel at the park into a proper painting as a thank you. "A ban?" Steve asks. "Bucky said no papers and no radio, unless it's music." "What?" Steve opens his eyes and gives his best shot at a glare, even though his eyelids are so heavy. He has a vague memory of Bucky violently turning off the radio and cursing to Rachel, shouting about a goddamn Father Coughlin wannabes. "For a while there, you couldn't stop worrying about the war when you should have been resting, so Bucky said no more war talk in the apartment until you're better." "I'm better," Steve says, even as his heavy eyelids betray him and he struggles to keep from drifting off. "Go to sleep, Steve." "Where's Bucky?" "He's at the garage. He'll be home when you wake up." "With his tata?" "Yes." "That's good," Steve says, letting sleep have him. "It's good that he's spending time with his tata." When Bucky gets home, Steve gets his bath. The hot water has him feeling more human again after so many days of fever dreams and lost time. Steve lays back, too tired to lift his arms to wash his hair. Bucky's sitting on the floor, resting his chin on the edge of the tub. There are dark circles under his eyes, like he hasn't been sleeping. "You look terrible, Buck," Steve says. Bucky snorts, rolling his eyes. "That's rich, coming from Mr. Death warmed over himself over here." "Well, I've got sickness as an excuse. What have you been doing with yourself?" "Working." at the garage, on top of going into the office. Bucky always ends up working himself to death to make up the difference when Steve can't pick up his normal array of odd jobs. And Steve hates this, worse even than being this sick. "I want to do it," Bucky insists. "You know I've always liked the garage best, and Tate's been good. We don't talk much, but it's nice to be around him without any more awkwardness." "But you're doing it because you're worried about money, with me being out of commission." "We're fine. I'm just making sure we still have something saved, is all. I'll cut back at the garage, once you're back on your feet. Don't argue with me." Steve growls a little, so frustrated he could tear his hair out. He completely submerges his head in the hot water and blows out an angry stream of bubbles. "I hate this," Steve whispers when he emerges. His face is wet enough to disguise any crying, so he lets a few angry tears fall. "I hate what you've got to do so I won't die. I hate it so goddamn much." "Hey, I'd be happy to do a whole lot more to keep you healthy, pal." Steve wipes at his face and then glares at Bucky, hard. The way he's leaning on the edge of the tub has them at eye level. "You take care of me too, Steve." Bucky reaches out to run his hand through Steve's drenched hair. Bucky talks right over him when he tries to protest. "You do. It's different than the way I take care of you, but it's still important. We're a team, pal. You and me in this together. And right now, I'm taking care of the money and making sure you get your medicine. But knowing I've got you to come home to makes my whole day better, you know? You're the only thing that makes seeing my family bearable. You make me better. Make me not hate myself so goddamn much. I love you a lot, okay? So maybe try not to worry about who's bringing home what money so much. We'll be fine." Steve wants to cry again. Getting so fragile like this is one of the worst side effects of getting so sick. "Wow, Buck," he says, voice breaking a little. "That was an awfully sweet speech. I think I need to suck you off now to pay you back for that one." Bucky grins, shaking his head and flicking water into Steve's face with his fingers. "You're ridiculous." "I'm serious over here." "Oh, I know you are. You were too delirious to talk to me for days and can't even manage to wash your hair on your own. There's no way I'm putting anything in your mouth but food and medicine, Steve-o." "What about the thermometer?" "Is this the part where you make some joke about taking your temperature with my cock? Because we really can just skip that." Steve laughs until he coughs. Bucky clucks his tongue and then washes Steve's hair. Getting him out of the tub is a team effort, and Bucky dries him off and bundles him into bed. Bucky turns off the light, pulls the blankets over their heads, and kisses Steve, gently, chastely. Bucky protests when Steve gets a hand in his underwear, but he relents when Steve murmurs, I want to, please let me, against Bucky's mouth. His own body is too worn out to respond, but when Steve watches Bucky's face, mouth slack, eyes closed, neck arched, head thrown back, it takes the edge off of how much he hates being sick. He takes care of Bucky too, after all. It's what married people do. Steve recovers from the flu, only to have a little cold turn into sinusitis a month later. Steve recovers from the sinusitis, only to land himself in the hospital a month after that with pneumonia for the third time in his life. It gets so bad when he actually shows up to sit with him. Steve's lucid enough to crack his eyes open and watch as she terrifies a doctor who dares comment that Steve's asthma is psychosomatic, simply the result of a weak will and frailty. That's the going theory around medical circles in regards to asthma, that the strain in his lungs is actually all in his head, but Winnie won't hear a word about it. "This boy is the strongest child I've ever known," she says, "looking 1,000 feet tall and capable of ripping your heart right out of your chest. Now you'll kindly treat his pneumonia and offer no commentary on his other ailments, if you please." Bucky hugs his mother like he means it after that, and when it becomes clear that Steve's no longer on the precipice of dying, Winnie gathers her coat, runs her fingers through Steve's greasy hair, and says, "Come to Mass when you're feeling up to it, and make sure Bucky brings Zelda. Strange that we haven't seen her around Assumption much this year. I'm going to start to think they're not together at all." Steve just sighs and thanks her for coming. He's lost months to being sick. Tomorrow he'll have to fight with Bucky over how much time he's been working to make up the difference. He'll have to stay awake long enough to get a painting done. He'll have to beg Zelda to come to church with him this week. But for now he's just glad he survived another round of pneumonia, when not even his doctor thought he would make it. He's just thankful that Bucky's not going home from the hospital alone. The girls are going to that new bar, Steve says when Bucky wakes up. It's May, a Saturday, and Steve's restless. He's barely been outside at all in months, and he's finally feeling up to do more than just sit out on the fire escape for his fresh air. In the village, that lesbian bar. There is no way in hell Bucky will be taking him out to a new bar with the girls after he's been so sick for so long. But this is a well-worn negotiating strategy with Bucky. Steve aims far too high to give himself room to negotiate down to what he actually wants to do. As expected, Bucky snorts, sitting up on both his elbows. He's stretched out beside Steve on the bed, in no hurry to get up and start the day. "You've barely been out of the apartment for months, and you're trying to go all the way to the village, to a goddamn lesbian bar that could be unsafe and just waiting to get busted for all we know. That's your idea of taking it easy." Steve rolls away from Bucky a little, hiding his grin in his pillow. "Sounds fun is all. Guess we could stick a little closer to home." "Oh, you guess, huh?" Steve can tell just by the tone of his voice that Bucky's caught on to Steve's tactics for negotiating and is begrudgingly amused. "Sure, a movie, and maybe a quick drink afterwards, if I'm feeling up for it." "You tricky little punk," Bucky murmurs, his breath close and hot. He nips at Steve's earlobe and slides a palm down the length of Steve's crooked spine, smacking his ass gently once and then leaving his hand there. "How come I'm always letting you get me all riled up?" Steve keeps grinning into his pillow. "'Cause you're easy, Buck." "For you, maybe," Bucky says, the words tossed out like they're nothing. Like everything Bucky does for Steve ain't a miracle and a blessing. "Congratulations, Stevie. You'll get your movie, but I ain't convinced on the drink yet." Steve turns his head and opens his eyes as Bucky slips his hand under the waistband of Steve's underwear, his hand just resting there, warm and possessive. They're close, closer and more intimate than they've been in weeks, and Steve's still too weak for it to go anywhere, but he sighs anyway. This is a good morning. Bucky's brow isn't furrowed with stress. Steve hasn't coughed once, and they're getting out of the apartment today, for a movie at the very least. "You're one hell of a negotiator, Buck," Steve teases. Bucky rolls his eyes and smirks. "Who says I didn't get just what I want? Now how about you kiss me for a while before I make us breakfast?" "I can make breakfast." "Not if you're still angling for Sully's after the movie, you won't." Steve sees no reason to argue these terms as Bucky pulls the blankets up over their heads. He gets to kiss Bucky for a solid 15 minutes. Lazy kisses. Kissing for the sake of kissing and nothing else. The kind that ease the ache of missing Bucky, even when he's been right here. Until Steve coughs a small cough, and Bucky decides it's time to eat. They make it to a manatee, and Steve's buoyant mood is dampened somewhat with the newsreels full of the war. Bucky's kept him updated with the basics of what's going on in Europe, but he's avoided the news, finally agreeing with Bucky that worrying about the war wasn't helping him get better. But the devil and Miss Jones is a good enough picture, and there is no one else in their row, so he holds Bucky's hand between the seats. "You didn't cough once during the movie." In the theatre lobby, Bucky leans close to speak right into Steve's good ear as they move slowly towards the exit. "Not once." "Not once," Steve echoes, far too pleased with himself, given that not coughing for a couple hours shouldn't be his biggest accomplishment of the week.
"I ain't taking you all the way to the village to meet the girls at some lesbian bar," he whispers. "That's always going to be a thrill, talking about their queer life out in public like this. Maybe it's the danger of the prospect of getting caught, even if that reality is one of Steve's greatest fears. Maybe it's just the joy of having a secret, sharing something so vital with Bucky. Whatever it is, Bucky whispers lesbian in his ear as they walk through a crowded lobby, and it makes Steve shiver, makes him grin.
"Fair enough," he replies. "But I don't see any harm in having a cold one at Sully's," Bucky continues, as if this news is going to disappoint Steve, when this was Steve's goal for the evening all along. As if Bucky didn't know.
"Just one, Steve, not five."
"Okay, okay." He elbows Bucky in the ribs.
"Let's get to it then, Mr. Bossy."
A block from Sully's, they nearly get ploughed over by a guy full out sprinting in the opposite direction.
"Hey, watch where you're going,"
Bucky bellows at his rapidly retreating back.
"Was that Andrew?"
Steve frowns as the guy rounds a corner and disappears from sight.
"The drunk one, not the nice one."
"Dunno," Bucky says.
"Maybe."
They share a look, both of them realizing at the same moment what that could mean, seeing a regular flee from Sully's. Steve's stomach drops, Bucky's eyes go wide with horror, and they just stand there for a few seconds, staring at each other.
"Could have nothing to do with the bar," says Steve.
"Could have everything to do with the bar," says Bucky.
"Only one way to find out."
Steve squares his shoulders and stands up as straight as his crooked back will allow him to stand. He's all set to march off towards Sully's when Bucky grabs his elbow.
"No heroics, Steve," he whispers, eyes darting everywhere.
"I mean it."
"Come on, Buck."
"No, no. If it's a raid, if the cops are there, you're staying right with me hiding across the street. You're not going to charge in there like you can fix it with your fists. You're not going to get yourself in trouble for no damn reason, just because you're mad and you've got rightness on your side."
"It might not be that," Steve says, but he's sick with dread. They got so damn complacent, got so comfortable at Sully's, they forgot what could happen.
"Steve, please, promise me."
"Promise."
They do lurk across the street, skulking in the shadows and watching in horror as the cops drag Sully out of the bar. He's got his hands cuffed behind his back, and they force him to sit down on the curb, next to Raoul and some other fella Steve's seen around but never met. Raoul looks terrified, and Steve wonders where Peter is, if he got away, if he left Raoul to get caught on his own. Sully looks furious and defiant, and Steve hasn't been this scared since his ma started hacking up blood. Inside, the cops seem to be doing their best to smash up the place. There are so many of them, four standing outside to keep watch over their prisoners, another horde inside. Two more arrive, dragging another prisoner between them.
"Who's that?"
Steve whispers, and they toss the fourth fella on the curb next to Sully. His face is a bloody mess, like the cops got in more than a few licks before bringing him back to the bar. The blood and Steve's eyesight make it difficult to see a face, but he looks young. He sways like he's going to pass out, and the cops laugh. Sully looks like he's a moment away from leaping up and throwing himself at the cops, even with his hands bound.
"Think that might be the new guy. What's his name?"
"Mark," whispers Steve. "He was sweet on Tobias."
"Shit, Steve. We gotta go. Who knows how many cops are out here, looking for guys."
"Rachel," Steve hisses, already moving towards the bar. Bucky's quicker and pulls him back into the shadow of the building.
"She's not here, Steve. She's fine. We gotta go."
Bucky makes them walk away slow, with a couple feet of distance separating them as they stroll away from Sully's. They get their story straight, that they're just a couple of guys.
"Cousins," Bucky says. "Tell them we're cousins."
Walking home after an unsuccessful date with a pair of frigid dames.
"I ain't gonna say that," Steve mutters. You sure as hell will. If we get stopped, we gotta speak their language, and we gotta be aggressively not queer. You can act normal for 5 minutes. It ain't gonna kill you. They don't get stopped. They don't see anyone. But instead of going back to the safety of their apartment, the only safe space left for them in the world with Sully's raided, and even that doesn't feel so safe anymore, they get on a train into the city. Turns out, they do go meet the girls at the lesbian bar. Even staying for the 5 minutes it takes to find Rachel and convince her to leave, Steve's stomach rolls with dread. He keeps looking at the door, expecting the cops to kick it in at any moment. Normally, he'd be fascinated by a place like this. It's all couples, gals who dress in suits and slip back their hair to look like fellas, and their feminine companions. Some look as sharp as Bucky when he's going out on the town. Normally, Steve would want to draw them, the juxtaposition of soft, delicate faces and harsh masculine collars with straight ties. Tall, willowy women draped over their small, dapper lovers. Big butch women who look like they'd give Bucky a run for his money in the boxing ring. And shy, coy girls who look like they'd fit better in a church than a bar, with conservative necklines and long skirts. And then there's the couples that don't quite fit, like Rachel and Zelda, both in fabulous dresses and bold red lipstick, the two most feminine things Steve's ever seen, but together just the same. Normally, Steve would ask Rachel if anyone gives them a hard time for it, or if most of the women here subscribe to Sully's philosophy of there's no wrong way to be queer. Except Sully's in chains, the safety of his bar gone, and Steve's so terrified of getting caught in this blatantly queer space that he can't breathe. On the way home, Rachel leans against his side. Steve gets an arm around her waist to hold her close, and she lets her head fall to his shoulder. Somehow, she doesn't cry, but she also hasn't said anything since they explained in hushed tones outside the lesbian bar. Across from them, Zelda's pale. She's got her own arms wrapped around her chest and leans away from Bucky, looking like she'll shatter if anyone touches her. The four of them stagger onto the street like they're soldiers, war-weary and shell-shocked. No one says anything until Bucky offers to walk Zelda back to her great-aunt's house, and Steve's so relieved when she just shakes her head in response. With the four of them together, there is protection. To anyone looking, they are two perfectly respectable couples. Well, one and a half perfectly respectable couples, and Steve. Any nosy neighbours watching them come home might be scandalised by the two women going unsupervised into the apartment of a couple fellas, but it's not the kind of scandal that'll see anyone in handcuffs sitting out on the curb. Who? Asks Rachel, when Steve gets her settled on the sofa with Zelda, and Bucky gets a glass of whiskey in her hand. Bucky looks a little unsteady as he sinks down into the chair across from them. Steve perches on the arm of Bucky's chair, somewhat comforted by the heat of Bucky's shoulder, leaning into his side. Steve rests an arm across Bucky's shoulders and takes a deep breath. Besides Sully, Steve says. Rachel flinches over the name. They got Raoul. Rachel lets out a little sob and covers her mouth. Zelda crosses her arms tight over her chest, curling into herself and hunching her shoulders. And the guy that lives out in Jersey only comes in about once a month when he's got business in the city, Bucky says. Don't remember his name. That could be Leo, Rachel murmurs. Or Gustav. Gustav's the Swede, right? Bucky says. Not him. Must be Leo. He's got 6 children, Rachel murmurs. The youngest is 5 months old. He was such a proud papa last time he was in. Who else? Toby's new sweetheart, Steve says. Mark's only 17, Rachel shouts, like she's not only 19. But from the day Steve met her, she's always seemed older. Maybe that's just the result of her losing so much so young, running away from home when she was so young. God, and now she's lost Sully, too. How'd this happen? Zelda whispers. Her gaze is far off and blank. Sully had a friend with the liquor board, or in the local police precinct, right? That's why he didn't get shut down by Mayor LaGuardia before the World's Fair in 1939. So what happened to that protection? I don't know,
Rachel murmurs. They're probably going to get in touch with Sully's wife. This is a nightmare. Sully's got a wife? Steve asks, shocked. Rachel nods, her bottom lip trembling. He hasn't seen her in years. He's got a kid, too. A son. The girls spend the night, taking Steve's bed. It's the first time they've separated the mattresses in years. With the lights out, Steve clings to Bucky, his head on Bucky's chest, tucked right under Bucky's chin. Bucky clings back. No one says anything until morning, but Steve's pretty sure nobody sleeps either.
It's not so bad. Steve lies through his teeth. Rachel simply glares at him, tugging the box from his arms and dropping it unceremoniously on the cot in the corner. She looks around with her nose in the air. Honestly, the small room is nicer than some places he and Bucky stayed right after they left the Barnes house, but Rachel's used to her own room in an apartment that took up a whole floor of Sully's building. She's used to big windows to let the light in, and a bathroom right there in her apartment. She's used to a full kitchen at her disposal, not a hot plate instead of a stove.
You better marry me soon and take me away from here, Stephen, she mutters, kicking at the cot until it's pressed up against the wall. Steve cracks a smile and squeezes her hand, before retreating down the stairs to get another box. She's been making jokes like that more often since Sully's arrest, but Steve knows she's more serious than ever about getting married. Steve would honestly do it tomorrow, if Zelda and Bucky would get on board. He's overheard a whispered argument or two, with Rachel insisting that getting married is the best way to stay safe now, and Zelda arguing the opposite, still too terrified from what happened to Sully to commit to a lifetime of queerness and a loving marriage. For days after the arrest, Rachel worked to get answers. Near the beginning, they actually let her see Sully, but then his wife showed up and put the kibosh on that right quick. Raoul got out okay, although he's made himself scarce around the neighbourhood, and they never did find out much about the others. With Sully's wife on the scene, she encouraged them to send Sully to a mental ward instead of jail, but they've got no proof of Sully doing anything queer. The only laws he's broken involve running a business that caters to queer folks, and if he ends up serving time, it should only be a couple years. Now, there's nothing to be done but help Rachel move into the tiny room above Frank's tailor shop in Williamsburg. She couldn't stay at Sully's, not after his wife showed up there, too. We'll have you over for dinner all the time, Steve says, as Rachel gazes around the room and fights tears. More like I'll commandeer your kitchen and cook you dinner all the time. Yeah, yeah. Steve pulls her into a hug. You're always welcome. Anytime. All the time. Zelda leaves the day after the Nazis start their invasion of the Soviet Union. Steve's sitting outside on the front stoop, waiting for Bucky to get off work and reading all about the invasion in the Eagle when Rachel appears before him, all pale and stunned. Oh no. Steve gates up at her. What happened now? Rachel lets out a humorless laugh and collapses next to him on the stoop. She loops her arm through his, burying her face in his shoulder. Rach? His voice wavers. She breathes deep and even. Zelda left. Oh. His first reaction is relief, that she isn't here telling him that Sully died in a cell or something terrible happened to another Brooklyn Jew. This doesn't seem like the world ending all over again, and ain't exactly a shock, given how scarce Zelda's been since Sully got shut down and locked up. Except it is the world ending, for Rachel. Oh, he says again, pressing a kiss to her temple. Oh, Rachel, I'm so sorry. They sit outside for a while, until Bucky comes home to fuss over them both, huddled together and looking pathetic. Rachel only starts talking when they get two drinks in her. She doesn't sob all over Steve's shirt, like she did over and over in the weeks after they took Sully away. Now she's too shocked to cry. She tells them about how hard it's been since Sully, how she's just been crying all the time, while Zelda seemed to be doing her best to pretend like it never happened, like the bar never existed. She tells them how Zelda's been quiet, withdrawn, how she never lets Rachel spend the night anymore, how there's a man at the hospital, a doctor, that's been trying to take Zelda out for ages. "She was messing around on you?" demands Steve. He's halfway out of his seat, ready to march across town to give Zelda a piece of his mind, but Bucky shoves him back down into his chair, and Rachel shakes her head.
"No, no."
Rachel blows her nose in a handkerchief, finally losing some of that stoic edge as she explains.
"Nothing like that. It's just, she's gonna give it a shot, with this fella, the doctor. She likes him, even if she doesn't love him. That's what she said. He's not bad company, and being married to him would be all right. She thinks he'll let her keep working."
"Jesus," Bucky mutters.
But...
Steve sputters, indignant, and has to take a few breaths to gather his thoughts. "But what kind of life is that? A loveless life? A life that's a lie?" Rachel's the girl that marched up to him and announced her queerness within 5 minutes of knowing him, all proud and tall and sure of herself. Maybe even a couple months ago, when she still had a home with Sully, she'd be as indignant as Steve. Now she simply shrugs. "It's a safe life," she whispers. "Zelda wants children and security, neither of which I can give her. I can't be mad at her about that, Steve. I hope she gets it. She loves me, she said so, but she doesn't want this life."
"Oh, Rachel," Steve murmurs as she finally starts crying. She hides her face in Steve's shirt and sobs.
"I'm making matzo ball soup," Bucky decides. Rachel lets out a grateful laugh and nods. She is always saying that things never look so dire with a belly full of matzo ball soup. "People leave," Rachel says after dinner. They're getting her settled on the sofa, insisting she stay. Neighborhood opinions be damned. Rachel's drowning in an oversized shirt of Bucky's. She's never looked so fragile.
"People leave. You'd think I'd be used to it by now, huh?"
"We ain't going anywhere," Steve promises, rubbing her back.
"Yeah,"
Rachel shrugs. "Thing is, with the draft going on, that's not exactly a promise you can keep, Bubbler. And don't even try to convince me that you won't be enlisting the moment the US finally ends up joining the war, official-like." Steve doesn't sleep much. Just clings to Bucky like his life depends on it. Through the summer, Steve returns to his normal level of health. He's tired all the time and achy, his stomach as sensitive as always and lungs wheezing, but it's all the usual. Steve learned to live with that a long time ago. It's bearable, even a relief, after spending the first half of the year in a near constant state of illness. It does unfortunately mean he and Bucky have got no excuses for getting out of family time with the Barnes. Going over there after church for dinner becomes a decidedly less pleasant affair after Bucky has to tell his mother that he and Zelda are finished. He manages to put it off for a couple months, getting through his birthday party with pretty lies about Zelda working extra hard at the hospital. But in October, Winnie asks him, straight to his face, if he's still seeing Zelda. Rachel's sitting right there when he bumbles his way through telling his mother that they've split. She's got to excuse herself from the table for a good cry in the bathroom. Rachel comes to all Barnes family events now, except for Mass. Mostly, Steve doesn't like leaving her on her own for any length of time, but it's good cover, too. Bucky might have failed to get a wife, but Winnie's still got hope for Steve. It's enough to get them through Thanksgiving with that incident. And then it's December again. The final month of 41 arrives with a fresh blanket of snow and a letter sitting on their table/bathtub when Steve gets home from teaching a class at the art center.
"What's that?"
Steve's hands are shaking. He doesn't need Bucky to tell him. It's spelled out for Steve, written plain as day on Bucky's pale, drawn face.
"Just read it."
Steve sinks into a chair at the table, reaching out for the letter folded neatly on the table, and Bucky stands, too jittery to sit. "This can't be right."
Steve reads the letter for the fifth time, and then blinks up at Bucky. He's pacing the length of their kitchen now, gnawing on his thumbnail. "Reporting December 27th, Bucky replies. "They're giving me through the holiday, at least." "This can't be right." "Of course it's right." Bucky stops in front of Steve. "Look, it's got the army seal and everything, all typed up and official."
But...
Steve sputters and runs both his hands through his hair. He squeezes his eyes shut and tries to breathe. His heart's racing, but it's not just his arrhythmia. It's terror. It's everything in him screaming, "No, no, no." "They can't just take you." Bucky looks at him like he's the greatest of idiots. "Of course they can. Steve, we put our names in for the draft together last year. Frankly, I got lucky it took them this long." "Bucky." Steve bites his lips together to keep from crying, but Bucky crouches in front of him anyway, resting his chin on Steve's knees. His hand comes up to cradle Steve's jaw, and Steve lets out a little sob. "You'll be fine," Bucky whispers. "I'll send you my pay so you can cover the rent. I'm not sure if I'll be pulling down what I get at the refinery, but it should be enough, especially since you don't got to worry about feeding me. Rachel promised to make sure you eat, to make sure to look after you when you're sick. She's going to go to Ma if it gets really bad." Steve jerks away from Bucky's hands, pushes Bucky away so hard he falls back to sit on his ass. "The fuck is wrong with you?" Steve demands. He gets up to take his turn pacing around the kitchen. Bucky says something in reply, but Steve's got his good ear turned away. Fuck his stupid ears. He can't even stomp around in rage properly, can't even fight with Bucky properly, when it takes only a couple feet of distance and the wrong angle to prevent Steve from even hearing Bucky's reply. Seething, Steve stomps closer to Bucky, sticking his neck out and tilting his good ear in Bucky's direction. It's an old tell, a silent signal that Bucky's got to repeat himself. "I said..." Bucky gets to his feet with an infuriating amount of grace and calm. "Nothing's wrong with me. Just trying to be practical about this. I don't need you to take care of me." It's like they're back in time 5 years, before Steve realized that they take care of each other. Before he decided that it was all right if Bucky fussed over him, so long as he could fuss over Bucky in return. They've been partners for a long time now, taking care of each other as naturally as breathing. Of course Bucky's gonna fret about disturbing the life they've carved out for themselves. Of course Bucky's gonna want to give Steve money to make sure their home stays stable. And Steve should just say, "Sure, Buck, that'll work." Because Bucky's going to the army, and he'll breathe easier if he doesn't have to worry about Steve getting thrown out of their place. He opens his mouth to apologize, but Bucky starts hollering before he can, and Steve gets mad all over again, because it's easier than being terrified. "Really? We're back to that fucking horseshit? What the fuck are you doing, Steve?" "What the fuck am I doing? What the fuck are you doing? You're going to basic at the end of the month, and instead of taking care of yourself, you're plotting with Rachel? And what the hell are you doing telling Rachel this before you tell me, huh?" Bucky throws his hands up in the air and starts up the pacing again. He's practically purple in the face with anger and frustration, but he still makes sure that Steve can hear him when he yells back. "Maybe I knew she'd just listen to me talk for 5 minutes instead of immediately getting her back up and flipping her lid." "I ain't flipping anything," Steve yells back. The neighbours are going to be banging on their walls and demanding that they shut it any moment now, but Steve doesn't care. Steve is so goddamn angry, and not really at Bucky, but even knowing that this is not the right outlet for that anger, he can't stop. "Just need to remind you that I'm capable of taking care of myself. I ain't your wife. You should be worrying about you, not me. This is how I take care of myself, you ass." Bucky stomps his feet and waves his hands around his head. "It's the same thing. Taking care of me, taking care of you. I need you to be okay when I leave. How do you still not fucking get that after all these goddamn years? Fuck you, Rogers." Bucky retreats,
fleeing to their bedroom with his arms crossed over his chest. The fight drains out of Steve so quick, it leaves him wobbly on his feet. He bounds after Bucky, catching the door when Bucky tries to slam it shut. The force of it will leave a bruise on his forearm, but he deserves the pain and more for the way he's been carrying on since he read the letter. No wonder Bucky told Rachel first. She probably held his hand and looked at him with those big, brown, understanding eyes of hers. She probably made him eat his weight in matzo ball soup. I'm sorry. Steve throws his arms around Bucky's neck, practically crawling up his body just to be a little closer. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. Bucky sighs and hesitates only for a second before returning the embrace. He lifts Steve off his feet. You should be sorry, you goddamn punk. You might not know this about me, Steve says, but I don't handle being scared very well. Bucky snorts and presses his nose into Steve's hair. I might have figured that out back when you were getting into 3 fights a day after your ma got sick. You're like a feral cat backed into a corner, you know that? So I'd rather lash out than cower, Steve says. But you're not who I want to fight. Well, I am a more convenient target than Hitler or the US Army. Come lie down with me. So they end up in bed, on their sides and facing each other. Between their bodies, Steve tangles their fingers together, and under the blankets, Bucky gets his knee between Steve's legs. I love you so much, Bucky says. That means I'm allowed to worry about you, don't it? Yeah, Steve replies. And I get to worry about you back. I think I'll do okay in the army. Sure you will, Buck. You'll charm your way into running the place as fast as anything. And you're pretty good at following orders. We might need to practice that a bit before you go, to make sure you're used to doing what you're told. Bucky laughs. Is that a sex thing, Rogers? Are you trying to prepare me for the army with sodomy? The kind of sodomy where you boss me around incessantly. Steve shrugs, but his blush answers for him. I'll let Rachel feed me, he whispers. It feels like a vow, a promise, a commitment to Bucky, rather than just assurances that he'll take care of himself while Bucky's gone. All the time, I'll let her feed me, and I won't just shut myself away in the apartment. I'll go visit Peter in Harlem. I'll go to Assumption every Sunday and have dinner with your family. I'll let Winnie feed me, too. I'll take Beck to the movies and the twins to Coney Island. At the first sniffle, I'll take it easy. I'll sleep more and tell Rachel when I'm feeling under the weather. And if it gets worse, I'll let her and your ma take care of me, or I'll go to the doctor. When you send me money, I'll use what I need for rent and put the rest under the mattress for a rainy day. Everything here's going to be fine, Buck. We've got a good thing going on, and this life of ours will still be here when you get back. There's no war yet. Bucky will go in, do his time, and come back. Sure, him being in the army will change things, but Steve won't let it ruin what they've built together, what they feel for each other. I don't want to go, Bucky murmurs. He looks so ashamed. Steve hides a flinch, because that statement smarts a little. If their positions were reversed, Steve would be raring to go, would feel privileged to serve. He refuses to resent Bucky for his healthy, fit-to-be-a-soldier body, and his lack of gratitude for the opportunity to hopefully carry out some justice. He refuses to be jealous of Bucky, when he's so scared and admitting he doesn't want to go. I don't want you to go either, Steve agrees, reaching out to trace Bucky's cheekbone with his thumb. But you'll be fine, Buck. We'll be fine. There ain't even a war yet. Bucky opens his eyes and sits up a little, resting with his head propped up on his elbow. I'll just be off learning how to make a bed with tight corners and that's all. Hell, maybe I'll even come back in even better shot and never even have to shoot anybody. Maybe I'll be able to outshoot Uncle Corman. Steve takes a deep breath, and even though he's been telling himself that there ain't a war yet, it feels like a lie. He doesn't believe it when Bucky says it, either. But Bucky needs him to go along with this joke right now. All the training in the world ain't gonna have you outshooting Corman, Steve manages. The man is a machine. I think he's something out of your pulps, Buck. Maybe that steady arm of his is made of metal. Darn, and I've just got these two fleshy things weighing me down. It's a real shame. Bucky laughs for a second, before he's back to grimacing. He flips over, burying his face in his pillow and muttering indistinctly.
What?
Asks Steve, poking him in the back. I've got to tell Tate, and Ma, but Tate's going to be worse. Steve rubs his back.
Yeah.
God, he'll probably do something horrifying, like cry.
Probably.
Bucky flips over again, on his back now and looking up at Steve, his eyes so wide and so blue. He looks young like this, eyes big and mouth slack, hair messy over his forehead. He looks too young for war, too perfect.
You'll come with me, right?
Sure, pal, I'll always come with you. On December 7th, 1941, Bucky gets sent home from work early. They shut down production of the whole refinery for the afternoon, and Bucky comes straight home. He doesn't say anything when he sees Steve and Rachel huddled together on the sofa, just kicks off his shoes and squeezes in next to Steve. Steve pulled their thickest, softest blanket from their beds, and he situates it over Bucky's knees now, making sure he's warm. Underneath the blankets, he's got Rachel squeezing one hand, and he takes Bucky's with the other. The radio drones on and hasn't said anything new in hours, but they all listen anyway. On the table are a variety of afternoon papers that also lack reliable information. Steve should be feeling more something. Anger, fear, despair, resolve. But he's too shocked to do anything but sit in silence, holding his favourite people's hands, listening to the same information filter through the airwaves. This shouldn't be such a surprise. Steve's been calling a situation just like this inevitable for years. How often has he said that the ocean separating them wouldn't keep America isolated from the war? How often has he insisted that eventually America would join in? They've certainly taken the steps, from neutrality to instating conscription to lend-lease. But Steve never thought it would be Japan, despite their conquering in Asia and the tension with America over trade. And he really never ever thought it would be on American soil. At some point, Rachel decides they all need to eat, and she hustles off to the kitchen, the sounds of cabinets opening and closing joining the monotone of the radio. Steve can't look Bucky in the eye. Just a handful of days ago, he promised to stay safe, to take care of himself, and to make sure Bucky has a home to come back to. But a handful of days ago, the war was still a faraway thing, and despite all Steve's big talk, he never truly believed it would touch American shores. Steve made Bucky a promise, but he can't keep it, not now. Everything's different than it was this morning, and there's no way Steve can sit safe at home with Bucky going to war. This has always been bigger than him and Bucky, just as always is. And now it's here, and Steve can't do nothing. But Bucky is so pale, and Rachel is so quiet, and Steve's hands are shaking. Tomorrow. He'll go down to enlist tomorrow. For today, they can cling to the small bit of safety they have left and stay home.